Now she'll be in quiet. She's in my lap. She's in your lap with some prasadam. Okay, it's August 15, 2010 at T.D. Shafi's house. And we are studying Shiva Mars's book, Sudha Bhakti Chintamani, chapters 27, Hearing with Steadiness and Taste, and 28, Hearing with Attachment, and 29, Hearing at Ecstasy and at Love. So this little chart that you have in front of you is primarily based on the Nectar of Instruction, text 8, purport. And this is a purport, it's actually by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. And Srila Prabhupada quotes Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's purport in his own purport. Now, Shiva Ram Maharaj discusses this with these terms earlier in this book. Then the notes at the bottom are from a class on the classes given on this book by Srimati in Vrindavan, if any of you know Srimati. And in fact, the whole concept of doing the chart like this came from her. But then I've expanded on the top portion, as the two bottom boxes, as I say, have come from her. So this should also give us a guide as we go through these chapters, because it's very much related. So on the top left box, Shravana Dasha, constant hearing, that is really up to where this section starts. So all of bhakti up to steadiness is contained in that one box in the upper left. So from faith, sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya, anarjana vritti is all in that box in the top left. So this is someone, until they've developed steadiness, then such a person should be hearing as much as possible about Krishna. And hearing means philosophy. You're hearing the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, the philosophy of the Bhagavatam. You're hearing about the different, what we call occasional pastimes of Krishna, in the sense that they're not going on in the spiritual world. Pastimes like chastising Kaliya, or appearing, you know, being born, killing Putana, etc. The pastimes of all Krishna's different incarnations, the pastimes of the devotees, Dhruva Maharaj, Maharaj Prithu, Prahlad Maharaj, that are described in the Bhagavatam. The story, of course, addition Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates. And this sort of hearing generally is done in a systematic or step-by-step fashion, so that one is, like Prabhupada said, that it's advised, it's not like it's some sort of a rule that if you don't follow, you're going to... The whole life will be finished, but it's advised that you start from the beginning of the Bhagavatam and you work your way through, verse by verse. So reading each verse, and Prabhupada said the Sanskrit, the Roman, the word for word, you know, the translation and the purport. So reading through in order, and Prabhupada also advised, for example, first read Bhagavad Gita, then read Srimad Bhagavatam, then read Chaitanya Charitamrita. Again, that's not a rule, because we would go out to the streets and distribute the last volumes of Chaitanya Charitamrita to people in general. So, it's certainly not some sort of a rule. But generally, in the beginning stages, one is doing that. One is trying to hear lectures and classes, you know, especially, I suggest people listen to Prabhupada's lectures and conversations. But one should be hearing about Krishna. And of course, not only hearing, but also chanting and so many things. And one should be trying at that stage. This is called progressive stage of remembrance. And although Shiva Ram Maharaj is entitled as hearing, this is not only hearing. This is really a combination of hearing and remembering that he's talking about here. Which is interesting, because I've had this book for a long time and I've never read through the whole thing systematically. And when I saw these chapters, I thought it was about something different, because it says hearing. And it really is, to a large extent, about remembrance rather than hearing. So the person up to the stage of steadiness is also remembering Krishna, shall we say, sporadically. I recall very clearly being at a meeting once with some devotees. Maybe some of you know. Am I speaking too fast for any of you? Do any of you have English as your second language? You do. Anyone else have English? You have English as your second language. Am I going too fast for you? You can follow...
They're used to me, and I speak...
Okay. You can follow full-on New Yorker speed. Okay. American, even with an American accent, you can do it with an American accent. On the continent, people prefer an American accent to a British accent because they grew up watching American television and American movies. And they all told me they can understand an American accent better. But I thought, okay, if you've got English as a second language and an American accent, I may be losing you because I'm just speaking English. I'm just going. So yes, I was at a meeting with Shawna Karishi, who you may know. He works at Oxford here in the UK. I can't remember exactly what we were talking about. Something political. Something political in this country. And he said, I don't like getting into that because then I forget all about the little blue boy playing his flute. And it was a revelation for me. All of a sudden I realized it's been a long time since I thought about the little blue boy playing his flute. And I realized that one can go on for a very long time, even chanting japa, going to the kirtan, reading the books, doing service all the time, and still not thinking about Krishna. And it's very possible. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
That you can go on not thinking about Krishna. I mean, Krishna is a person. It's like if I'm going to think about Chidi Shakti, I'm going to think about what does she look like, what does she do, what does she act like. It's not a vague thing, thinking about Chidi Shakti. It's like it's not a philosophical idea. Does that make sense? You know, if I'm going to think about the people I'm attached to who are at a distance from here, like my children and grandchildren, if I think about them, I think about them. You know, their form, their name, their qualities, and their activities. And my relationship with them. It's very concrete. I may also be thinking about ideas in relation to them. Certainly. And I may be thinking about things that I want to do for them, or things that they're doing for me, or things that we're doing together. Oh, I have to talk to so-and-so about such-and-such kind of thing. But I'm certainly thinking about them. So the beginning devotee into the stage of steadiness may sometimes go for a long time without really thinking about Krishna. I mean, they're thinking about the work they have to do for Krishna, but not so personal. And such a person has to really make an effort to think about Krishna. Okay, now I've got to think about Krishna. Now it's time to think about Krishna. Because there's not much real love. You know, if I love somebody, there's no effort to think about them at all. Zero. In fact, there's an effort not to think about them. And get on with your business of the day, because you know, you have work to do. You can't just sit around thinking about the person you love kind of thing. So the fact that the beginning devotee struggles to hear about Krishna, to think about Krishna, shows that there hasn't yet developed some deep attachment. There's some attachment. There's some attachment, certainly. Or we'd be just out in the world. Then at a certain point, we come to Varnadas. Now, Varnadas is at this stage of hearing with steadiness and with taste, which Maharaj has put into one chapter. So at this point, one becomes really attached to hearing. Now, I don't know how much you've emphasized this, so I may be repeating something, but do keep in mind that these stages are not boxes, although they are on this piece of paper. But in real life, they're not boxes. I mean, and if we just think about, this is an example I always give, of human development. So, you know, here we have little Anayor, who's three. And if we think about human development from, she's not three yet, 2.5? She's so mature. So if we think about, you know, from, let's just say birth. Let's say from birth to 16 or 18. So you can have general stages you can talk about. And there's different researchers that have come up with certain stages. There's, you know, 1 to 3 month stage, and then 3 month to 1 year, and then 1 year to 5 years, 5 to 7, 7 to 10, or 10 to 12. I mean, you can, and different people will divide them up different ways, wouldn't they? I mean, if you were to say, okay, take stages of human development and create boxes. Everybody, all of us go, we have an assignment, we all create boxes. My guess is we would create slightly different boxes. We would group ages differently, right? Now, the other thing is if I say, okay, I want you to make stages of human development according to physical development. Now go do it according to social development. Now do it according to intellectual development. Now do it according to sexual development. Now do it in emotional development. Your boxes will be different. What you're going to group together will be very, very different. If I said sexual development, your first box would be huge. It would cover most of childhood, right? If I say physical development, you're going to have a lot of little boxes. Depends what we're looking at. And then if you went to take any of those boxes and apply them to a particular person, they're not going to quite fit. And the boxes don't quite correlate with each other. So if you're looking at social development and physical development, that you can't say, well, at this stage of physical development, you're going to be at this stage of social development. You might be, you might not be. So if we were to all make these little boxes and we were to say, this is box 1, 2, 3, 4, box 1 on this system wouldn't correlate to box 1 on this system for an individual, or even on an average. You know, and then if you're going to look at general development, well, if you're going to look at general development, a person's going to be, you know, general development box 1. But an actual person may be socially over here and physically over here. And I mean, one of my children developed physically very slowly, so he always looked 2 years younger than he was until he was probably about 17 or 18. Now he's the tallest and biggest of my children, but he always looked 2 years younger. And intellectually, he was developed very fast. So intellectually, he was about 2 years ahead. So by the time he was 4, he knew most mathematics that children know by the time they're 8 or 9. But he looked like he was only 2. So, you know, we'd go to the shop, and it looks like there's this 2-year-old kid there, and he'd be able to figure out, this was in the days before credit cards were very good, we still used mostly cash, you know, and he'd be able to figure out all of the numbers as if he were 8 or 9 years old, although he looked like he was 2, and people were just, whoa. So his intellectual development was far beyond his physical development. You know, and then emotionally, he was probably about average. So you had this sort of funny thing, or I remember a student I taught who started developing sexually at about 9, but everything else was average. So she was a very confused person for a while. You know, she didn't know, am I a teenager, am I a child, or what am I, or how do I feel, or where do I belong, and like that. So this same thing happens with spiritual development. So when we look at how we mature spiritually, each of these ways of categorizing things, they don't all match up, and they're not quite the same for different individuals. So we're really looking at 2 things here. We're looking at stages of hearing or stages of remembering. To me, it's easier to think of it as remembering rather than hearing, although Maharaj is calling it hearing. And then we're also looking at Shraddha to Prem. So when Maharaj is using words such as steadiness and taste, attachment, ecstasy, and love, he's using the Shraddha to Prem boxes. Yes, steadiness is Nissa, taste is Ruchi, attachment is Shakti. Ecstasy is bhava and love is prana. So he's using those particular boxes. Now, he could use other boxes, but those are the ones he's using. Those are a little bit easier to use than, say, the Kanista, Majjhima, and Uttama boxes, because those boxes are much bigger, and also because they're defined very differently in different places. Whereas Shraddha to Prem is pretty much defined the same way everywhere. So it's a little easier. People know what you're talking about. So he's trying to relate different levels of hearing with these different stages. And I will just tell you frankly, there's not an absolute matchup between levels of hearing and those other boxes. Is that clear? So this is a very important thing to remember, because when Maharaj is describing what kind of hearing / remembering one is doing at the stage of attachment, there's this chart shows levels of hearing and remembering. Okay? So you're taking these boxes of development, the boxes of how you develop in hearing and remembering. Then you're taking another set of boxes of Shraddha to Prem, and you're trying to say how do they match? Well, they don't absolutely match. They don't absolutely match. So for the sake of simplicity, Maharaj is writing about them as if they absolutely match. But they don't. And especially they don't absolutely match for an individual. So that it's very important to keep that in mind. These are general guidelines. And there's fluidity. And there's interim periods. Does that make sense? So my suggestion is that we look at this, because we are talking about stages of hearing / remembering. My suggestion is that we look at it much more through this model, which is a little different way of organizing it. But it's, we're looking at the same things, we're just looking at it through a different model. And the reason I suggest that is I think it may be easier to understand as far as what one's progress is. All right, so the Shravana Das again is just general hearing, a general hearing of all of Krishna's pastimes. There may be very little really remembering Krishna. You know, there's some effort to remember Krishna. There's an attempt to remember Krishna. It doesn't work terribly well. You know, it really doesn't work. It's really a struggle. You know, what does it mean to remember Krishna? And you kind of have, okay, I've got a certain time of the day when I do my sadhana where I really try. Right now I'm going to remember Krishna. But even then it's hard. Even at that time in the day, it's hard. What to speak of the rest of the day. But an effort's being made. Then at Varnadasha, which is where we're really starting with chapter 27. At this point, one becomes very attached to hearing and very attached to remembering. So this is, I like that Maharaj describes this as kind of the bridge between Vaidhi Bhakti and Raghunuga Bhakti. Vaidhi Bhakti is when I'm doing things primarily because this is what I'm told I'm supposed to do. Obviously, there's some individual attachment or we wouldn't be here. Nobody in modern society is following Krishna consciousness, or let's say almost nobody, is following Krishna consciousness because this is what we're told by our authorities we're supposed to do. Our society is screaming at us not to do this. You know, everywhere around us, all of the advertisements and the media and the education system, and they're all telling us that doing this is absolute, total foolishness. So it's not that we're doing this because we're just following authority. There has to be some, even for the rank beginner in Krishna consciousness in modern society. I mean, maybe there's a few people who are just here because their mommy and daddy told them to do it, and that's what they were raised, and they were raised just in Mayapur Dhamma, and they only saw their Hare Krishna devotees, and they never thought about anything else. But I tend not to believe that, because even in Mayapur Dhamma, there's all kinds of other influences, and they certainly know there's a big, bad world out there. So there had to be something where we was like, yeah, I really want to do this. This is really nice. This really intrigues me. In other words, there has to be some spontaneous attraction. If there's not some spontaneous attraction at the present age, I don't think you're going to take up Krishna consciousness. I'm sorry, I don't think you're going to stick to Krishna consciousness, but I don't think you'll even take it up. So we're not saying that there's no spontaneous attraction. At the same time, the primary reason for doing what one is doing is because this is what I'm told I'm supposed to do. So even if there's some spontaneous attraction, we're chanting 16 rounds because Prabhupada said to chant 16 rounds. That we probably wouldn't have said on our own, I think I'd like to chant 16 rounds. You know, we're going to Mangalarti because Prabhupada said to. We're offering our food because Prabhupada said to, because that's what it says in the scriptures, because that's what we're told. This is the processes that will bring us to where we want. So now at Varnadash, we're actually become attached to these things. We're starting to do them in such a way that we would do them anyway, without there being some kind of a rule, without somebody telling us to do them. It's just like, you know, if you're, I don't know how many of you have ever been in love with a boy, but if you're really in love, you don't need to be told. There was a song when I was growing up, you know, if you really want him to love you, you should wear your hair just for him and do the things he likes to do. But that's just natural. Nobody really needs to tell you to do that. You know, if you're in love with a guy, you're going to wear your hair the way he likes it. You just are. You're going to wear the kind of clothes he likes. If he says, you know, I know one girl whose husband said, I don't like you wearing a sweatshirt with a hood. So she would never wear a hood. You know, and if he had said, oh, I think you look really cute with a hood on, then she would have worn it. Again, she didn't have to follow a rule book. if your husband says this, it just becomes natural. You know, if you care about somebody, or just like, you know, if you're having a guest over to your house, I'm often a guest at people's houses, and they generally ask me, what do they ask me before I come?
What do you like to eat?
And that's just normal. It's spontaneous. You don't have to, what's the etiquette rule here? You know, it's just normal. Without thought. Or the mother with the baby, you know, the baby cries, you want to hold the baby. Maybe you have to follow a rule that tells you don't hold the baby, you know. People write these books, don't hold your baby when they cry. But the natural tendency is to do that. So at this stage, one starts becoming attached. That one starts to want to hear about Krishna, whether there's a rule to hear about Krishna or not. One starts to remember Krishna just naturally because you like Krishna. Exactly like all of us naturally remember the people in our life that we care about. We also naturally remember the people in our life that we don't like and that we're worried about. We do both, isn't it? If there's people causing trouble in our life, let's say when there's people causing trouble in our life, then we naturally think about them. Oh, this person is causing me trouble. I'm going to have to see them at work, or they're going to send me an email. What am I going to do? How am I going to reply? How am I going to deal with it? I was dealing like that just recently with somebody over email, and I would find myself sometimes thinking for large chunks of the day, you know, how am I going to reply to this person? And then I'd think, oh, what a stupid waste of time. What a waste of my energy. Then I keep thinking about how am I going to deal with this person. So, again, that's natural. And at this stage, one starts doing that with Krishna. So there starts becoming large chunks of time when one is just thinking, oh, Krishna did this pastime, or what's Krishna wearing, or what does he look like, and how can I please him? And it becomes natural. But at this stage, there can be, Maharaj talks about really two different types of person at this stage. One person who really hasn't developed internal spontaneous attraction for Krishna, but who's become very purified of the modes of material nature and has come to the intellectual conclusion that they should at this point start intentionally cultivating a spontaneous relationship with Krishna. So such a person imitates the behavior of spontaneous devotees. And he says that this imitation is not like the sahajiyas. It's bona fide. But such a person is not yet on the spontaneous platform. Now, I remember a few years ago talking to one sannyasi who was very, very clearly doing this, who told me, you know, I just decided that I was ready to start cultivating spontaneous devotional service, and I started doing this, and I started doing this. And I could tell by listening to him that it hadn't come from some experience, it hadn't come from some change within him to the spontaneous platform. It had come from an intellectual decision that now I'm ready to do this, which I found quite interesting. You know, because I remember thinking at the time, is that proper? Is it proper to start that path before you've really had some change in your consciousness? And reading this, he says, yes, it is. That can be done at a certain stage. You say, okay, now it's time to do that. I mean, I think of that something like it used to be, that people of a certain age had their parents start looking for a prospective husband for them. You know, got to a certain age, whatever it was, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, something like that. And your mother and father started looking for a husband for you, even if you didn't necessarily show any signs of being interested. And one of the things that I tell parents is, say you don't necessarily want to wait until your kids show signs of being interested. It's one place where Prabhupada said, you know, the parents should arrange a marriage before their children go mad. Because once they go mad, they may get attached to anybody. So it's something like that. Your kids may not be showing any signs of interest in the opposite sex at all. But you see that they're physically ready. You start seeing that their physiology has changed. And you know, sooner or later, they're going to start showing some signs. So let me start going through the process of looking for a husband for them. So that's this idea of imitating. That a person says, well, you know, I've developed enough in my Krishna consciousness, I should start doing the activities of spontaneous devotion, even though I don't feel spontaneous yet. And the other is somebody who's sort of on the bridge. So they're still, to a large extent, regulated by the injunctions of the Shastra. They're still doing a lot of things because it says so in the Shastra, because it says so by the Guru. If it weren't for the Shastra and the Guru, they wouldn't be doing those things. At the same time, they're starting to get a very strong attachment to Krishna as a person. Not attachment to the idea of Krishna, not attachment to, in some philosophical way or some abstract way, but getting attached to Krishna, the person. And generally that happens through some kind of transcendent experience. Is that clear about the two different kinds? So we could say the first kind is again, somebody's 14, but they really haven't had any interest in boys yet. But the mother says, okay, I think we're going to start looking for a husband for you. And starts discussing it with you, and okay, what kind of boy do you think you might like? But it's kind of all theory. And the other is that the girl at 14 is looking at some guy and going, oh. And then the mother says, I think we should start looking for a husband for you. So, of course, when the girl at 14 is looking at a boy and saying, she's not yet fully developed in her feelings. They're still immature. Or what to speak of if she's only 12. You know, if a girl at 12 years old is going, over some boy, it may not be developed yet. It's real. It's real. And it's spontaneous. She's not acting that way because her mother says now it's time. But it's still immature. So those are the two kinds.
So the first kind is not really the highest intellectual way of intellectual.
Well, Maharaj is saying it's also fine. I mean, I'd say the difficulty with that is, how do you really know then that you're ready if you don't have any feelings? And I don't personally know the answer to that. In fact, it was interesting for me to read that here, because I had always thought that just wasn't advisable at all. At the end of the book, Maharaj gives a fictional story of a devotee who goes through the process, which I personally have read, six or seven times, and found very helpful, because stories are so much easier than theory. And you see that he, to some extent, does some what we would call imitative practice. That basically his guru says to him, you're ready to start doing this even though you don't feel it yet, and now this is what I want you to start doing. And that's what you find in that story. So I'd say that could be done under the direction of somebody who really knows you and knows what you're doing, and it should be done with confirmation. And my own feeling is kind of against it. My own feeling is definitely kind of against it, because I think there's a danger of people doing it too soon. And why risk that? But it is also fine. You know, if you're at a certain stage of realization in general, you know, you wouldn't be doing that, at least, you know, I don't think you'd be doing that for a girl who's 8. You know, you want somebody at least to be over puberty. And now, it's interesting that Maharaj also said, this meditation is unsystematic. Well, first he says substantial faith, the person who's mixed, who's sort of on the bridge between Vaidhi Bhakti and Raghunuda Bhakti, he says they have substantial faith, but frail greed and immature knowledge. So by knowledge here, Maharaj is not talking about technical knowledge of the Shastra. He's not talking about scholarly knowledge. He's talking about realization. Because you can be a scholar at the lowest level of devotional service. I mean, he's not talking about being a scholar. You can be a scholar and not even be a devotee at all. So, and there are such people. There are people who know Jiva Goswami and Rupa Goswami's writings a lot better probably than any of us do. I just met such a person in Italy. She's not a devotee. And she studies Jiva Goswami's instructions on Raghunuga Bhakti, which she knows inside and out and upside and downs and backwards and forwards. You know, much, 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 much better than I know them. I mean, we're not even in the same room. So you can certainly be a scholar and not even be a devotee. So that's not, when he says immature knowledge, that's not what he means. That's not what he means by knowledge. It doesn't mean how many verses you can quote and that kind of thing. But knowledge about, really knowledge about Krishna, realized knowledge about Krishna. So you have some knowledge about Krishna, but it's very beginning. You have some genuine greed. Some genuine greed, but it's frail. It's not solid. It's just at its beginning stage. It's like a little plant. And you have very firm faith. You have very, 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 very firm faith. So then it becomes more, again, you know, you're still the sort of a mix. Well, I really want to think about Krishna. I really want to remember Krishna. What are the rules I have to follow to do it? It's more that kind of thing. And this, saying the meditation is unsystematic and tainted with mundane topics. So a person at this stage who's starting spontaneous practice, their meditation on Krishna is haphazard. Sometimes they'll remember one thing, sometimes they'll remember another thing. You know, they'll remember this thing about Krishna. And it's very much mixed with mundane things. So they have genuine feelings for Krishna, but there's a mix of mundane feelings also. And a person at this stage is very aware of that. They're very aware that there's this mix of mundane emotions and spiritual emotions. Before this stage, one may just take one's material emotions as if they were spiritual. One may think their material emotions are spiritual, or one may just see all their emotions as material.
3, 4, 5.
Okay, now he says here, the most notable change in devotees free from the lower modes is that they begin to perceive their own devotional tastes. They start to see whether their tastes are regular, spontaneous, or a combination of the two. They start to be aware of their own tastes. Okay, questions on this chapter? He brings up the idea about multiple identities. Did any of you find that interesting? This is a question that I get asked a lot. I mean, it's not one of the top 10 questions, but something that I definitely get asked a lot. And I get asked all different varieties of this question.
Sorry, any chance? God, this is all offered, right?
Oh, yeah. So generally with people, what I see, the fear behind these questions are, am I going to have to be something eternally that I don't like? That's my conclusion, that's really what's underneath the question. And I've decided that that's what's underneath the question because that's what's going on in the material world over and over again. Basically, in this material world, I have desires. I do activities. Those desires and activities get me a body and a life. And then when I get it, I'm not really very happy with it. It's very much like you do a whole lot of research and care. You buy something, and then you bring it home, and you go, oh, it's not what I wanted. Why did I buy this? Why did I spend the money on this? Hey, you all done that? You all bought something, and then you brought it home, and you thought it was going to be perfect, and you were really happy with it in the store, or when you placed your order on the internet or whatever, and then when it came and you started using it, like, oh, my God, why? Oh, I spent £20 on this. It was just worth nothing. What am I going to do with this thing? And I see that our material life is very much like that. We each have our, I know, I have this particular body basically because I wanted it. I ordered it. I special ordered it. And I did. I want this kind of, this body and this body. And then I get it and I go, oh man, it's not what I want at all. You know, or initially there's a few things about it. I like, there's some things I like about my body and my, I think, yeah, that's cool. But most things I don't like very much. And so then we start thinking, okay, well, let's try again. Let's go shopping for a new body, you know? And we've been doing this for a long time. We've been going shopping for bodies for a long time. We've been trying on all different ones of them, bodies and minds. And none of them have been quite to our liking, which is one of the reasons that there's death. So none of them have been quite to our liking. And we keep trying out different ones. And so we think that getting a spiritual body is going to be something like that. That, you know, I'm going to sit down and think, wow, okay, being Krishna's parent, that sounds really nice. It sounds really, really nice. It's really sweet, you know, and I like being a parent in this world, and I like kids, and, you know, I think that would be good, and maybe I'd like to be, you know, one of the Krishna's parents, and I'll think like that, and then I'll actually get to the spiritual world, and I'll be one of the parents, and then I'll go, oh, this wasn't what I wanted. But now I've lost my chance, you know, I wanted to be one of the young gopis now, but now it's too late, now I'm stuck being Krishna's parents, and here I am eternally in the parental rasa. So we tend to kind of put that material idea onto the spiritual. So the thing that we're told over and over and over again is that we have an eternal relationship with Krishna. Eternal means it has no beginning and no end. And at the same time, it's something that we've chosen. Now you can say, how can I choose something if it has no beginning? Because choice to me means that there was a time when I didn't choose it, then I choose it, and then there's a time that I have chosen it. I think of choice. But that just simply doesn't apply, that idea of past, present, and future. So it's something that I choose, let's say, present tense, because I exist eternally and I exist always in the present. So something that I choose, it's something that I choose, it's my choice, it's my decision, and it is also something that exists eternally. It's my eternal choice. And each relationship with Krishna is perfect, so there's no question of having an imperfect relationship with Krishna. Oh, you made it! There's plenty of room here. Come on in. Don't squish by the door. But I find that even answering like that doesn't usually pacify people. I find that even if I say, you know, it's eternal at the same time as our choice, that if you look at people, and you can tell that they're still not comfortable with it. They're still thinking, well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, suppose that my eternal choice is to be a rock, and I really don't like it. So the other answer that I give, and when I give this answer, I find that people are 100% satisfied, is what Maharaj talks about here, that that one can have more than one relationship with Krishna, and he talks about how there are living entities who have one relationship with Krishna in Vaikuntha and another in Vrindavan, and even some that have more than one relationship in Vrindavan. And of course we know that there are living beings who have one relationship in Chaitanya Leela and one relationship in Krishna Leela. That's very common. In fact, almost all the associates of Lord Chaitanya are listed as this is their relationship in Krishna Leela. And some of them are listed as having a relationship in Ram Leela. So I can't remember any specific examples, but I'm sure that there are people listed as this is their relationship in Ram Leela, this is their relationship in Krishna Leela, this is their relationship in Chaitanya Leela. I mean, I know for sure there's a pastime that happens by Govardhan Hill where Krishna appears as Ram, Balaram appears as Lakshman, and the cowherd boys appear as monkeys. And many of them, of course, are also in Chaitanya Leela. We know that Lord Nityananda used to play as Lakshman, and his friends would play as monkeys. And then those same friends are also cowherd boys in Krishna's pastime. So there are certainly those examples of people who are existing in three different forms with three different kinds of relationships in three different leelas all simultaneously. And then you might say, well, you know, how can I be in more than one place at once? And my answer is that all of us would like to do that. And it's a desire that all of us have at least sometimes, that we like to be in more than one place at once. And I think those desires come from experience, that we've had that kind of experience. Especially, I remember in school, I used to regularly wish that I could also be at the beach. It was a regular thing. I wanted to be in school so I would be able to pass my exams. I didn't want to just skip school and go to the beach, so I wanted some part of me to be at school, but I also definitely did not want all of me to be at school. Anyway, so he brings this up, and he brings up the point, a quote from Chaitanya Chandradaya Nataka, where Lord Chaitanya is saying that even if you normally reside in Vaikuntha, I will also bring you to Vrindavan to be my eternal associate there. So this is one of his pieces of Shastric evidence that in joining Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, one can exist in both in Vaikuntha and in Vrindavan. Okay, any other questions on this chapter?
Are you still on Varnadasha, or are you going into Smarna?
We're on and Varna Dasha only. Chapter 7, hearing with steadiness and taste.
Spontaneous attachment than someone else when they start. Is that why they tend to follow? Or that like eagerness to follow?
I'm not sure if I understand what you're asking.
Because you said that everybody has some spontaneous attachment at the beginning.
In general. Well, you wouldn't stay. I would be very surprised if there's more than a handful of people practicing Krishna consciousness at the present time, especially outside of India, who don't have some spontaneous attraction.
They come from here too.
Why would you do it? You know, if we were in a society where everybody was a devotee of Krishna and that was the societal standard and that was what all your families did and those were the rules everybody followed, then there might be people who did it just because that was what everybody else was doing.
But the spontaneous attraction, especially at the very start, may not necessarily be for Krishna the person.
No.
Maybe for other aspects.
But there's some spontaneous attraction to something about Krishna consciousness. We wouldn't say such a person was on the platform of practicing Raga Nuga Bhakti. But the reason I bring this up is that, you know, if you look at yourself and try to figure out, well, am I on the Vaidhi platform or am I on the Raga Nuga platform, you're going to see in yourself some spontaneous attraction, no matter what stage you're on, even if you just came and you just started chanting Hare Krishna yesterday.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Hare Krishna.
Like that. That's spontaneous.
Pink, 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 pink.
But it's interesting because at Back to Godhead magazine, we receive a lot of stories how I came to Krishna consciousness. And it's extremely rare, if ever, that we find a story where someone says, the only reason I came was because of the philosophy. In fact, generally, people don't talk about the philosophy very much at all. We reject a lot of articles because they'll have zero philosophical content. You know, I really like the chanting. I love the food. I felt like I was home. You know, we find that primarily it's a spontaneous attraction. And the philosophy is usually secondary or at least parallel. At least parallel. If someone just says, I joined the Hare Krishna movement because of purely intellectual conviction and I had no feeling, I haven't seen any such thing. I know that Ravindra Suprabhu tells the story of how Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Vishnu Jan Maharaj, who used to do a traveling festival program, you probably have heard of them, they used to take buses that were converted into temples and travel around America and do festivals. They would go to universities or public parks and they'd set out a madras and a harmonium and they would have bhajan and then they would and a little talk and they would distribute prasadam. And Ravindra Suprabhu was saying that he asked Tamal Krishna Maharaj, how do you decide what persons really to spend time cultivating and preaching to? And Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, well, after we've had the bhajan and short talk and we've served the prasadam, then I go around to people sitting on the grass and I just say to them, what do you think? What do you think of the music? What do you think of the food? And if they say, yeah, it's good, then I don't talk to them. But if they say, yeah, I really like this music or I really like this food, then I'll spend time with them. So basically, he was looking for someone who had some sort of spontaneous attraction. And Ravindra Suprabhu decided that he was going to test this. Well, he's a scholar. Mm-hmm. So he was walking around the lawn, and he came to one young man, you know, so what do you think? Yeah, it's okay, it's good. Nice music, nice food. So Ravindra Suprabhu sat down and talked to him for an hour about the philosophy. At the end, the man said, yeah, you know, it's very interesting. I'm sure most of it's true, but I don't really think it's for me. So that's what I mean by a natural attraction. Something that's spontaneous, something that's not coming because you're supposed to follow it. Does that make sense? Obviously, that's different. The sort of spontaneous attraction we're talking about here is really a very strong attachment to Krishna, the person, where one starts to feel some natural, spontaneous affection for Krishna, the person. Not even just for the practices. Is that clear? And you'll find that Srila Prabhupada will often talk about these very advanced stages, referring to behavior and attitudes of very neophyte devotees. It's quite common. Prabhupada in his lectures and conversations will talk about, you know, these devotees are chanting and dancing in ecstasy. Or obviously they have taste. And he'll be talking about Shraddha to Prema, and he'll get to Ruchi, and he'll say, just like these devotees have so much taste for Krishna, otherwise why are they working so hard without pay? Now, does that mean that he believed that all those devotees were on the technical stage of Ruchi? I don't think so. And the reason I say I don't think so is I know one of them who wrote to Prabhupada, how do I go from bhava to prema? And Prabhupada said, don't ask this question now. So, but Prabhupada would use these terms definitely to describe behaviors of beginning devotees. Because they exist, I think I was reading this from Burjan, they exist to some extent, even in the beginner. They're just not developed. I mean, in one sense, you can talk about these stages as the gradual development of something. Like you have a tree with peaches on it. So, you know, first you have just the little flower comes. Then when the flower gets, then at the base of the flower, if it's a female flower, at the base of the flower is usually a little ball or a little oval. And once the flower has been pollinated, the flower falls off and that little ball or oval, little sphere oval starts to grow. It starts to get larger. And as it gets larger, it starts to assume a specific shape, the specific shape of that particular kind of fruit. Generally in the beginning, it's green. No matter what kind of fruit it is, it will be green, although the final form of fruit is all different colors. And, you know, it gradually starts assuming the shape, and it gradually starts assuming the color. But you can say, as soon as it's pollinated, you can say, oh, that's a mango. Oh, I see mangoes growing on the tree. I see apples growing on the tree. I see pears growing on the tree. So that means that, to some extent, there's a pear there. You can't say it's not. If I say, well, that's not an apple because I can't eat it yet, if I could, but it would be pretty. Ugh. But no, it is an apple. So in one sense, all of these higher stages exist to some extent, in some form, as soon as Krishna consciousness starts. In fact, they exist ultimately in the soul in a dormant form all the time. Love for Krishna is dormant in the heart of every living entity. It always exists in every living entity. So as soon as it's pollinated, shall we say, as soon as the seed starts to get a little watering, so these higher stages manifest to some extent, at least the shadows or reflections of them manifest. So there's shadows and reflections of these higher stages even at a lower stage. But we can say when it becomes really a just another example is being an adult and being a child. So there's reflections or shadows of adult desires and adult activities in children. Children naturally imitate the behavior of adults. They talk about what they're going to be like as an adult. They think about what they're going to be like as an adult. They're naturally attracted to becoming an adult and to imitating adults. So that exists even in very young children. Right? I mean, certainly in a child of 2 years old, it's already there. You can see the beginnings of adult things and the tendency to want to be an adult. It's not as if there's nothing and then all of a sudden it's like that. But so when we're talking about somebody who's gotten spontaneous attachment for Krishna, that's much more like talking to somebody who's already entered puberty or somebody who's, you know, that there's something that started to mature. there's some flavor. You know, you still don't want to pick the apple then and eat it. But if you did, it would have some flavor. You follow? There's a certain point at which there's no, you wouldn't use the fruit for anything. You know? Then there comes a certain point where you, at least you could use the fruit to make pickles. It starts to be in the range of edible. So that's what's sort of happening here. You're starting to be in the edible range, although you're really not. I'm sure you're. Anything else on chapter 27? You wouldn't have any like fishermen's friends or anything like that in the house, would you? I forgot to bring any with me. Anybody have any cough drops? Or we'll survive. Nothing else on chapter 27?
Go away.
Excuse me.
Oh,
okay. I thought you were talking to me.
No.
Okay.
I'm drawing.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Drawing.
You're drawing.
Drawing.
Okay, I thought you were telling me to go away, and I felt sad. All right. Hearing with attachment. Now, hearing with attachment is smaranavasta. Oh, thank you. And I want to emphasize again that there's not an absolute correlation between these. It's a rough correlation. Thank you. Now, this stage has five substages, which are not so much discussed in this chapter as such, although they are discussed elsewhere. But we're going to look at them through that. So this requires great submission and determination. At least that's Maharaj's statement. And Srila Prabhupada says great determination is needed until steadiness, and then everything comes automatically. But he also talks about great submission and determination. He says at this stage, hearing and remembering reveal an intuitive thought, though not realized, of one's eternal relationship. So at this stage of hearing and remembering, one gets an intuitive thought, though not realized, of one's eternal relationship. What he means by not realized, in other words, it's not realized in any detail. There's no detail to it. And the detail that he discusses is the one discussed by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the 11 aspects of our eternal personality. Our name, our form, our residence, our service. So those things are not revealed. This reminds us of a statement in the Brahma Samhita where it said that Lord Brahma realized that he was the eternal maidservant of Krishna, but the details of that were not revealed to him at that time. It was more a general feeling. So at this point, there's a general feeling, I am Krishna's. Krishna's like my child or my subordinate, or Krishna's like my master, or Krishna's like my beloved. You're all dirty. Or Krishna's my friend. But
who are you, friend?
Are you my friend?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. I was worried.
What's this?
I don't know, but you're all dirty.
I take a video.
You're taking a video? Wow.
Get on your
computer. All right, now something happens at this point, and I'm going to say for the zillionth time that you cannot say that it cannot happen before this point or it cannot start after this point. You cannot put things in neat little boxes. But generally speaking, at this point, one will start one's hearing and one's meditating becomes in a mentally conceived body. Because at this point you have an intuitive sense of what your relationship with Krishna is. And this scholar I was listening to in Italy spoke quite a bit about this mentally conceived body, how Jiva Goswami explains it, and how eventually one has one's eternal body. This mentally, yes?
How is mentally conceived different from mentally concocted in imagination?
It isn't. In fact, the word is often used imagined, a mentally imagined body. It is not one's eternal form. And Maharaj says, it's just like we use our present physical body to serve Krishna, even though this physical body is not us. So at this stage, one serves Krishna in a mentally imagined form without trying to figure out the details of that form. Because that's not known.
That's a big mountain.
So one doesn't know yet one's eternal name, one's exact eternal form. It's what we call a general or prototype body.
That's a good detail. Good topical.
How to explain it?
Good topical.
I like the way Marge explained it in terms of kind of reminds me of how karma explains how your subtle body is already developing according to the next body you're going to acquire. So by engaging in this mentally conceived body, you're also preparing to then receive eternal body.
Okay, very nice. I'd say the difference is before this, you're just meditating on Krishna's pastimes. And at this point, you're more meditating on your entering into the pastimes. Oh, I should say something, which I don't think Maharaj mentions here, or he might mention another part of the book since I haven't read every part of the book. But the Srila Prabhupada talks about a lot. And we're going back now to our first two boxes. We're going back to our box on the top left, which is where you are until the stage of steadiness. And we're going back to the next box as well. Srila Prabhupada speaks a lot about meditating in a mentally imagined body on doing deity worship. And of course you know, I hope you know, the main example given. Any of you know the main example given? The story Prabhupada tells.
What does your coffee there?
Honey, I'm busy right now, sweetie. Prabhupada gives a story he tells all the time about a person who meditated in a mentally imagined body on doing deity worship. Yes. He talked about this poor brahmana who heard that mentally done worship was the same, had the same effect as physically done worship. He was very poor. So he mentally imagined himself. Now, we'll assume that his imagined body looked very much like his gross body. In other words, we might assume that when he had a mental picture of himself doing things, that self that he imagined probably looked like his gross Brahmin body in the world. And in that mentally imagined body, he was going to the Ganga and collecting Ganga water. He was going to the Jamuna, collecting Jamuna water. He was bathing the deity in his mind. He was dressing the deity in his mind in gorgeous clothes. He was cooking for the deity. We know that because he cooked the sweet rice. And at a certain point, his meditation was so deep, he was in samadhi, that he actually burned his finger, his physical finger, by meditating on touching the hot sweet rice. Srila Prabhupada talks about doing this kind of meditation from the very beginning of Krishna consciousness. And it's something he says a lot. As in a goodly number of places, not only once or twice. He says it in a number of purports. He says it in a number of lectures, especially lectures and purports. I haven't found it so much in letters or conversations. I found it in a lot of lectures and purports. And Prabhupada will often talk about doing this kind of meditation while chanting. That meditate on seeing the form of the deity or meditate on serving the deity while chanting. In fact, he gives us as one rule that one should imagine that one is massaging the feet and legs of the deity. That like when one is sitting in the temple, one should imagine that one is massaging the deity's legs and feet. So, based on these very, very clear and numerous instructions of Srila Prabhupada, and I know that other people will say other things, but I could easily give you all the quotes if you like. I don't have them right in my pocket right now.
Magic.
I would say that one kind of hearing / remembering that even the beginner is advised to do is this meditating on service to the deity. Now, what here we're talking about, a mentally conceived body, is a little different. Because at this point, the person has now got at least an intuitive idea that I'm a cowherd boy, for example. I have feelings toward Krishna as a cowherd boy. So then their mentally conceived body is doing things in their meditation, such as, you know, fanning Krishna or throwing a ball to Krishna, right, or playing wrestling games with Krishna, and they're imagining serving Krishna in that way, very much like the beginner was imagining themselves serving the deity. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But the person doesn't think that there's, first of all, they're not really concerned with imagining any kind of details of this mental body, and nor do they think that the body that they're imagining is their eternal body. And you might say, well, what's the purpose of this? And I really like where Mara said, the purpose of this sort of meditation at this point is not to develop rasa, because you can't develop rasa until your identity is firmly known. You have to really know who you are. I can't have a relationship with you if I don't first know who I am. If I just have a vague idea of who I am, I can't really have a relationship with you. I have to actually know who I am. Now, one of the things that is generally done...
I'm making noise.
Do you know that you're a typical Indian mother?
What?
Do you know that Western mothers do not follow their children around when they're playing and put food in their mouth?
It's only when I do something like normally she just sits in one place in her high chair and eats.
You know, really, that is such an Indian thing to do. Can you do that in another room, honey, or because that's kind of disturbing?
That's
right?
Really loud.
Yeah, that's too loud, honey.
No,
the whole thing. Even if you do it quietly, it's still too loud. That's good. Yeah, you can do that. You can definitely do that. What was I thinking of comparing it to? I don't know if I can give any kind of comparison. Oh, yeah. He said it's not to develop rasa because you don't know who you are. I was going to say that before people give a talk, a public talk, often they're introduced. You've noticed this?
Mm-hmm.
And ISKCON, I find it's very variable. I find that Bhagavatam class speakers are hardly ever introduced. And that you're usually introduced just if you're giving a special talk or if you're giving a talk to non-devotees. It would be nice always to introduce speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought for a long time about why we do that. Do you know, why do we introduce speakers? Yeah, to give some credibility. Because why should I sit down for an hour or two listening to this person if they don't know what they're talking about? You know, in other words, you're establishing a relationship. You're saying, this is a person who you should accept as a teacher because of such and such and such. And if you don't know any details about the person, it's very difficult to establish a relationship. Here's just somebody sitting up there speaking. Why should I have a relationship with them? And if you go to hear a new speaker from whom you've heard no introduction, I find that it takes at least 15 or 20 minutes before you really kind of decide whether or not I want to trust what this person is saying. It takes a while to kind of develop, and you may have some hesitancy. Who is this person? Why should I listen to them? So it's very hard to have a relationship without having a clear sense of identity. It's why we also introduce people. If you go to any kind of gathering, you know, you have a name tag or there's some, people have a business card. Who am I talking to? What's your background? Does that make sense? Okay. So I can't really develop rasa, which has to do with relationships, until I really know not just, well, I really feel like I'm a cowherd boy, but until I know who am I exactly. What kind of a cowherd boy am I? Krishna's age, older or younger? You know, how am I related to him? What kind of services do I do? I don't really know that in the beginning. So what is the purpose? And Mara says here that it has two purposes, which I put in the recollection box. That the purpose is to cultivate attachment for Krishna and eagerness for perfection. So at this stage, one is not cultivating rasa. One is cultivating increased attachment for Krishna. Now, you don't do this until you have attachment for Krishna and until you have some general idea of your rasa, because you can't even have an imagined body unless you have a general idea, unless you have some intuitive idea, some intuitive attachment. But you're increasing your attachment for Krishna and you're increasing your desire for perfection. Does that make sense? Okay. So in the beginning of this kind of hearing or remembering, now we go to recollection, it's interrupted. It's unsystematic. So the devotee is remembering spontaneously, but they just sort of remember random things. of Krishna's pastimes, and they think of random things. They have random meditation. They're not really absorbed in Krishna's whole day. I'm just thinking, this isn't happening so much right now, but there was a time when it was. My kids and I live in very different parts of the world, and we used to all live really next door to each other. I mean, like a 1 minute walk or a 30 second walk. And I would see my children and grandchildren every single day. We were very close. And when we scattered to the far ends of the globe, for quite some time, I found that I was thinking about them a lot. And I was very aware of what time it was, wherever they were. I mean, I still have a pretty good awareness of what time it is where my kids are. You know, I have a pretty good idea what time is it there with. And as I change time zones, which I do a lot, I'm aware of what time zone it is there. And I have a good sense of what they're doing. I mean, some of that's for practical purposes, because I may need to contact them and are they sleeping, etc. But so that comes at the stage of absorption. At absorption or uninterrupted, then as soon as one thinks of one of Krishna's pastimes, one starts thinking of Krishna's whole day. Mm-hmm. And one sees the pastimes in the scope of all of Krishna's day. Whereas the stage of recollection is sort of more random. I'm thinking of Krishna here, I'm thinking of Krishna there, I'm thinking of Krishna here, I'm thinking of Krishna there. So at absorption, it becomes uninterrupted. One flows into the whole day of pastimes. But it's still not that concentrated. And then at the middle stage, it becomes concentrated. One really mentally enters into the pastimes to do service. I put that in that particular box, that one can be mentally entering into the pastimes to do service before then. Or after that. It's not that that only happens in that particular box, or that it only starts in that particular box. But at this time, it becomes a very concentrated thing, because one's attachment has become stronger and stronger and stronger, so one's meditation is more like that. Then it finally becomes a constant remembrance. So it goes from being periodic and unsystematic to periodic and systematic, to periodic, systematic, and concentrated, to constant, concentrated, and systematic. Is that clear? So it starts out, I sometimes am thinking about Krishna's pastimes throughout the day in a mentally constructed body, an unsystematic way. To I'm sometimes thinking about Krishna's pastimes in a systematic way in a mentally constructed body. To I'm thinking about them in a very concentrated way, but it's still sometimes. It's become much more concentrated, much deeper, much clearer. To I'm thinking about it, practically speaking, all the time. That there's two tracks going on, where I'm functioning in the world, but at the same time, I'm always thinking about serving Krishna in my mentally constructed body in a general way. Without thinking that the ways I'm thinking of serving Krishna are my specific eternal service, or that, you know, I'm not, even if I'm mentally throwing balls to Krishna in the pasturing grounds, I don't necessarily think, okay, that's my eternal service. But, you know, I have some eternal service as a cowherd boy. All right, then we come to the point of spiritual trance or samadhi. So, trance or samadhi implies that you lose awareness. It's a stage past pratyadhara where you lose awareness of the external world. And we all experience this in deep sleep or even in dreaming. So when I'm dreaming or in deep sleep, I don't have a sense of the room around me anymore. I don't have a sense of the position of my body in the bed. I don't have a sense of the furniture in the room around me. I only have a sense of a mental world. And the sense I have of that mental world is pretty complete. I'm living in the mental world. I'm not living in the gross world when I'm dreaming. So samadhi is very much like that, except that it's under the control of the person. A deep absorption like that in Krishna. Now we should emphasize that this, and this is something that Maharaj really emphasizes, that this is still on the material platform. That is still basically imagination. Now, for the 10 zillionth time, these are not firm boundaries. So Krishna can appear briefly and to some extent way before this. So that a person may have some experiences, even a very beginner has some experiences that are not fully on the material platform. Even someone just, I mean, I remember we were in Germany at the Pandavasena program, and there was this one hiker who decided to stop by and check out the Hare Krishna temple. Remember that guy?
Yeah.
And I was preaching him a lot. And after maybe 3-4 days, he said, I'd like to try to chant japa. So he took some beads and he disappeared into the woods on the property. And he came back after an hour or so and he said, that ought to be a controlled substance. And I was thinking, not every devotee feels like that every time they pick up their japa beads. Remember that?
Yeah.
Were you there in the room when he said that? And that's Krishna. That was Krishna breaking through the mind and revealing himself. Not fully, I'm sure. But it was Krishna. That was not on the mental platform. It wasn't. I talked to one devotee who's not even practicing consciousness anymore. He's interested in Brahman realization. And he told me that once when he was serving Tulsi Devi, that he saw each Tulsi plant as Vrindadevi. He saw Vrindadevi manifest in each of the Tulsi plants. So that's not on the mental platform. Or one of my favorite stories is Indrajumna Swami had used to serve in New Mayapur in France. And he was a grihasta. So he was visiting. And he was in the temple room, and the head pujari and her husband were also in the temple room. She was telling a story. She said all of a sudden when she looked at the deities, she saw Krishna. There's Krishna Radharani, there's Krishna Balaram, there's Govinda. She said, deities, she saw there's Krishna. And she says, wow. And about, she didn't say anything to anyone. She said about a week later, her husband came to her and said, did you see anything unusual in the temple room when Indrajumna Swami was there looking at the deities? So that's Krishna who just decides he's going to appear. And why he does that and when he does that and to whom he does that is his own business. And he can do that at any time. So it's not that, okay, well, I'm just going to be on the mental and material platform until Bhava, and at that time I'm going to be on the spiritual platform. No, one will get glimpses and reflections and shadows of the spiritual platform all along in various ways, whether it's just even like I was talking about this morning where you eat some prasadam and you're just like, what is it? You know? Or you go into kirtan and, you know what, Chidi Shakti? Just leave her. She's okay.
You sure?
Your anxiety about her is more disturbing than she is.
Okay, fine. I'll just leave her.
Just leave her. I don't know about everybody else. I'm used to children. They don't disturb me. I don't notice them. But I'm picking up on your anxiety about her.
I'm really anxious about her.
Just let it go.
Okay, fine.
Okay? We all know that everyone who's come here knows that she's here. We all knew before we came that she was going to be here. And if someone didn't like that, they shouldn't have come. And she's allowed to just be who she is and be two, and it's okay. And we all recognize that two-year-olds have very little sense of propriety or appropriateness. It's all right. As long as she's not banging the blocks together or screaming her head off, it's fine. So, you know, Krishna, and the fact that Krishna appears to somebody on day two doesn't mean that person is instantly, you know, on the platform of prema, either. I mean, he can appear in many different ways. He may show up and say hello, and it may just be that you have an incredible experience during kirtan or during prasadam or during book distribution or reading a book, or you're just like, what is this? But at least until this stage, the majority of the time, we'll say the vast majority of the time, the person is still operating on the material platform. A person at this point is really in the mode of goodness. In order to be in samadhi, you have to be very much in the mode of goodness. And the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance interfere with samadhi. And this is certainly a platform of great happiness. All right, from this platform, one enters into the stage of apanidasa, or samadhi. So that will be the next chapter. So any questions on chapter 28?
something from my back garden.
Hey, Anayura, would you give me some more water? Please?
Yes.
Thank you, sweetie pie.
Well, I just, there's a question on page 635. What happens when devotees think that the forms they're mentally confusing are their actual spiritual bodies?
Mm.
Is that a mistake that someone does
yes.
on a very high level platform?
Yes, that is a mistake one can make in a high level platform.
Can you repeat your question? What did you say? The question, what happens when devotees think that the forms they're mentally conceiving are their actual spiritual bodies? So I thought it was just something that neophytes
do. No. There are, Bharat Maharaj made a mistake at the stage of Baba. So there at each platform, there are different sorts of mistakes that one can make. You're actually more likely to make this mistake in a high platform than in a low platform.
That's enough water.
Why don't you stand up
first? Okay. Oh, thank you.
Move.
No, that was perfect. You really had the right amount there. You knew exactly how much water I wanted. Thank you. That was very smart.
Said to me. Enough, mommy.
That's right. That's what you did. You said to your mommy, that's enough, mommy. And you were right. Thank you very much. You're very smart.
Too much.
Yeah, there was going to be too much. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Very good.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Because one is still on the material platform. Maharaj makes this point that because you're still on the material platform, you're still subject to the four defects. Obviously not as much. But yeah, they're still possible. Any other questions on this chapter? Okay, chapter 29. So now we're at Samadhi as Apanadas and Sampatidas. So Samadhi, he's putting in the stage of Baba. And here he's saying that the difference that happens here at the stage of Baba is that one's meditation is no longer mentally imagined. It's no longer coming from the material platform. It's no longer on the stage of the mind. I mean, you can think of even in beginning Krishna consciousness, you might hear about Krishna killing Agasura, and you make a picture in your mind of Krishna killing Agasura, and you think about it with the mind. It's imagined. You don't believe, we don't believe, that we necessarily know what Agasura looks like. We don't believe we're actually seeing Krishna killing Agasura. We're thinking about it with the mind. Lord Kapiladev says that one uses the mind as a hook to capture the Lord. Of course, the trick is that service offered with the mind is as real as service offered with the body, just like that story of the Brahmana, or the story of Nisinganda Brahmachari, who made that road for Krishna, for Lord Chaitanya out of jewels. That's another example of service offered with the mind. So that service is real in the sense that Krishna accepts it, and the love is real. We don't have to offer service to Krishna with your physical body for it to be real. In fact, the physical body it exists, but it's basically an illusion. The physical body is not less of an illusion than the mind. If anything, the physical body is more of an illusion than the mind. The mind is closer to the spiritual than the body is. Okay? So, like that. So to think about Krishna's pastimes using the mind, or to think about entering Krishna's pastimes using the mind, it's a very similar thing. But at this point, Krishna actually descends. Krishna actually manifests within the heart of the devotee, and then you're really seeing Krishna's pastimes. And he says Prabhupada refers to this as spiritual television. And that you can see many of Krishna's pastimes. You can see Ramachandra's pastimes, the Singhadev's pastimes. I know one devotee who was saying, he said, all I have to do is just turn the channel in my heart and I can go to any of the pastimes. I don't need to watch the Indian movies. And not only does one see it, but one enters into them. You know, with modern technology, they really try to make fantasy worlds that you can enter into. The modern computer games are just like that. You know, where you develop a character. You know, they really try to take it. That's, you develop a mentally imagined character in the computer game. You've all seen people play computer games, or maybe some of you have played them. And you enter into this fantasy world, and you're doing things in the world with other people who have taken their own assumed characters. Pretty clever. I mean, it's, unfortunately, it's all a waste of time.
Quite obsessed. People are quite
obsessed. You get very
people who spend most of their hours of their day.
I have met many of them. I had one as a guest at my house once. He woke up at 5 in the morning, didn't bathe, didn't brush his teeth, turned on the computer, and didn't come to any meals. I don't even know if he used the toilet all day. He was there for 15 hours.
Wow.
I don't remember him getting a drink of water.
Probably drank it virtually.
Sure, eventually, yes. Eventually, he's still living, so he must have had water to drink eventually. But at least for that 15 hours, he was on the computer.
He probably brushed his teeth virtually in the computer.
Man, must have been. I don't know. I had another time when I went to visit a former student of mine who I hadn't seen for years. I also knew his wife, though not as well. And I was with someone else, and we were there with him and his kids. And where's your wife? Oh, she'll come. And as we were leaving, she comes out of the room in her pajamas at middle of the day. And she said, I'm really sorry I didn't spend any time with you. I had to help my brother get something on the game that we're playing. Her brother's another part of the world, you know. And I had to...
Wow.
That's what it does to people. Pretty amazing stuff. But you can see how much we want to go back to God. How much we really want this absorption in a better place, you know, in something. And these computer games, people have bodies that can, you know, jump off cliffs and then be restored. Or, you know, what they show in the movies, too, where these people do these amazing things and a gazillion people are shooting at them and they're fine. Right. Jump off of helicopters. And I think it was with Hema Ladini. Yeah, we were looking at computer bags. We're looking at laptop bags. And there were they were selling monitors in the shop. You know, right next to where we were looking. Their house gets blown up and they're fine. You know, it's... Okay. I don't know what show it was. You know, they fall out of a helicopter, their house gets blown up. And so we all want that. We all want to be in our invincible spiritual body, having all kinds of incredible adventures with Krishna. And we want to enter into it. You know, there was these 3D movies also, like this Avatar movie. And one of the reasons, I'm sure that one of the reasons it was so popular was that it was a 3D movie with a whole fantasy world.
There's
4D
now.
4D? How do you do 4D? What's the fourth D?
When I went to university in America, they have things like, so they were sitting in a seat, the seat moves.
Oh, the seat moves.
And they spray water at you from the seat in front, and you feel air under your feet.
Oh,
no,
the
water
thing. No, it's not. I was just speaking to my uncle today, actually. He goes, they went to see Shrek, and the spider crawling, it's actually literally a feeling of fear.
How do they give you that?
Because on the feet, there's vibrations.
Oh my, I would not want that.
I would
want that.
I said it's pretty cool. I want to go home. It's
quite disturbing.
But
some people like being disturbed. They go, people watch
go
horror
to be
films
disturbed.
And be disturbed.
Disturbed, yeah. Well, that's they're looking for the ghastly rasa. They're looking for one of the secondary rasas of ghastliness and dread. But anyway, we have a desire. You know, why are these movies so popular? Because we want to enter into another world. We want to enter. We don't want to just watch it. You know, it's one thing to just watch a movie. It's a whole other thing to watch it in 3D. And it's a whole other thing to go into a computer game. So at this point in the meditation on Krishna, one is not just seeing Krishna's pastimes. One is entering into Krishna's pastimes. So at this point, one's spiritual body becomes revealed. And one is no longer in Krishna's pastimes in a mentally constructed body. One is in Krishna's pastimes in one's own eternal form. And one is also, of course, not only seeing oneself, but one is seeing Krishna and his associates. And Maharaj says that this gets revealed gradually. Now, I wonder upon reading this if that's always the case or if it's different for different people. He didn't give any source for that. So in other words, the 11 items of our spiritual body, our age, our form, our particular service, our idea of perfection, all the things that make up our identity, he says those 11 things become revealed gradually at this stage. And again, I don't know if that's true for everybody or for some people they're revealed immediately. So at this point, one is living in the material world. One is very much living in the material world. But on a spiritual level, one is engaged in the spiritual world. Now, again, all of us have some idea of what that would mean. Just like little Aniyor here. Honey, that paper belongs to Mitali. Can you give it back to her? Just like little Aniyor here, she's in the same room that we're in, but she's not fully in the same room. She's also living in her own world. And she can sit down with these blocks, and she's in another place. Or Prabhupada also gives the example of a person falling asleep. So nobody here is sleeping, but it sometimes happens in a class that somebody falls asleep. And then they're technically in the room, but they're not. They're someplace else. So Prabhupada uses that as an example. And many times he gives the example. We all have the experience that we're someplace physically and someplace else mentally. Especially if we're really worried about something. So if there's some sort of attachment, positive or negative, to something, that, oh, you know, I gotta go to work tomorrow, and I'm not gonna have my papers done on time, and my boss is gonna be really, really angry, or, you know, I'm going to India in 2 days, and I gotta pack my bags, and, you know, whatever, some attachment that we're in a place, and we're hardly aware of what's going on. Right? Or we're partially aware. And you can even be, how would you say, very efficient at doing your work while your mind is elsewhere, depending on what kind of work you're doing. And Shivaram Swami says that the times when that's not there is during preaching or casual conversation. He said when there's preaching or casual conversation, it retreats to the background. And how did he put it exactly? I don't remember if that was in this chapter or the one before.
Find my angel of death. Angel of death.
Oh, I really like also that he makes the point that when the devotee is seeing these pastimes they're participating in, they don't participate in all of Krishna's pastimes. So in some of the pastimes they're personally participating, the other pastimes they see in the mood of separation. I wonder if it was here or in the previous chapter. Let me see if I can try to find them.
Well, when he talks about it receding.
Yeah. Is that here in the previous chapter? Where he says it doesn't interfere with, like, eating. Because there's a whole section in 28 about the Babaji's, which I'm not going to go through. I suggest you read it, though. And if you haven't read it, I suggest you read it.
I didn't know that there were so many different types.
Yeah. I mean, I would suggest you read it just for two reasons. To know what's out there, and also to alleviate your fear that at this platform, if you get into these kind of meditations, that you're becoming a Sahajiya. In other words, he's saying there's a Sahajiya way to do this and there's a bona fide way to do this. It's not that there's only a Sahajiya. Let's see if I can find where that is. Okay, this is all about the Sahajiyas.
And then I and the color ones and the star ones.
Mm-hmm. And this will be it's interesting, on page 629, so we're going back a little bit. He's still talking, he's here in this chapter talking about the devotee doing service in Krishna's pastimes in the mentally constructed body. And he says here that devotees in attachment are so absorbed in thoughts of Krishna that they feel as if they are living with him, they are unaware that their experience is only a meditation. So you can see why. Because
I'm
going to
say sorry.
You're scared. Remember what I compared this to? I compared it to what? To dreaming. That when you're dreaming, you're unaware that your dream is a dream. So this is a purposeful meditation. It's a purposeful meditation. It's a deliberate meditation. It's not a dream where you're just under the control of the mind, taking them here and there. You're using the mind rather than the mind using you. But it becomes so real that you don't see it anymore as a meditation at the deeper stages. To you, it seems like it's real, although it's not on the spiritual platform. That's why there's a danger of thinking that it's spiritual, because it seems very real. But I'm still looking for that. I don't know where it is. I can find it on my computer. Anyway, in one of these two chapters, I don't remember, he was saying that activities like eating and dressing do not disturb the meditation, but that when one is doing things like preaching and in casual conversation, the meditation recedes to the background. Otherwise, it's always present.
Oh, yes, page 628.
Ah, so it wasn't the previous chapter. Thank you. Okay. Oh, good, okay. Oh, so this, he's talking about, this is still the mentally constructed body. So he's saying, wherever they go, whatever they do, such remembrance follows them like calves following their mothers. Now, that would be obviously at the constant rememberous platform.
The pictures.
That would not be at the recollection, absorption, or meditation platform. It would be at the constant platform. External activities such as eating and sleeping do not disturb their meditation. Sleeping. So on this platform of anusmriti and samadhi, your sleeping is no longer sleeping. When you're in sleep, even when you're sleeping, you're in a state of spiritual trance. Only when they preach and associate casually with others does remembrance of Krishna retreat to the background of their thoughts. But when such fortunate souls chant japa or sing in kirtan, they drown in the nectarian ocean of Krishna's name, form, and qualities as they taste inconceivable happiness in worshipping the holy name. Like greedy men who have acquired their first wealth, devotees with taste cannot get enough of chanting Krishna's name. Okay? So that's talking of still the mentally conceived body. This is still on the material platform. That's still on the material. Okay. Going ahead. Thank you for showing me where that was. Okay, ecstasy and love. So now one is really entering in. Now one is really having the spiritual television. I mean, obviously, the person at the lower stages in the mentally conceived body feels like, I'm really living with Krishna. This is real. And then when they get the real spiritual thing, they say, whoa, this is a whole different experience. This is actually now Krishna. And this is actually me. And he's talking about having ecstatic symptoms. Of course, these appear in a lesser degree. Even a beginner can experience some shadow of ecstatic symptoms.
I just want one picture.
And here he's page 656. He says, at practice, the divine realm about which devotees hear is a spiritual reality far distant from the hearers, whereas at ecstasy, it is the reality in which they live, therefore it is known as the stage of application or apanadasa. No matter how much a person hears about the sweetness of nectar, the joy of hearing these descriptions pales besides the pleasure of actually tasting nectar. So then, you know, here we're getting, one's having the full, actually even this is not the full experience. So at each step the person is thinking, you know, wow, this is wonderful. So when in the mentally conceived body, one is thinking, this is wonderful, this is perfect, I'm always with Krishna. And then at the stage above, one is like, wow, this is the real thing. I'm really tasting nectar. Okay, before we go on to love of Krishna, any questions on bhava or apanadasa? By the way, why do we study this? I'm going to assume that none of us here are at the stage of bhava,
no.
Although that would be awfully nice. But why are we studying this if we're not at the stage of bhava? Why? Why do we want to know our destination? Yeah. Just like you recently went to Hawaii. You know, why'd you go to Hawaii? Because you heard it was a nice place. You see some pictures of it, you hear about it, and then you I'm sure it didn't cost only 10 pounds to get there. You know, you save your money, right? And you go through some tapasya to achieve it because you become convinced it's something worth achieving. Everything we do, all of us are doing austerities. Everybody's doing austerities. Why are we doing austerities? Because we're thinking that the goal we'll achieve will be worth it. Prabhupada says one should become captivated by this information. Any questions about bhava? Okay, now to prema. So prema is sampati das. So I really like, I think I'm just going to read this description because it's just so wonderful. And this description is very much like that of Madhurya Kadambini, where Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur describes prema, but described a little differently. Actually, just recently, where was I? I believe I was in Radadesh in Belgium. And we were reading about King Malayadwaja and his wife Madarekshana when in the fourth canto of Bhagavatam, when they go to the forest and King Malayadwaja is entering into samadhi. He's entering into spiritual trance. And this very thing was described not in Prabhupada's purport, but in the purport of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So he was saying that King Malayadwaja was fully meditating on Krishna within the mind. But he said that that's not fully satisfying. You want to see Krishna face to face. And at a certain point, Krishna came to him face to face, and then he left his body. So the Lord's appearing, I'm on page 661. The Lord's appearing only in a devotee's mind. Now here again, this is not the mind. This is the Lord appearing in the mind. So this is not a mentally constructed or mentally imagined idea. We're now, this is Krishna appearing in the mind. The Lord appearing only in a devotee's mind satisfies neither the hero, the heroine, nor their eternal companions. Srimati Radharani, therefore, takes Krishna by the hand and brings him to where their devotee is doing bhajan. The divine couple, now by bhajan we don't mean somebody sitting down with the harmonium. By bhajan, we mean that somebody is in a trance of samadhi, although they may also be playing the harmonium. And they also be chanting on japa. They're in a trance of samadhi where Krishna is fully within their, appearing within their mind, and they're participating in the pastimes. The divine couple watch for some time as their devotee, absorbed in confidential services, lovingly chants their names. To draw his attention, the hero and heroine suddenly disappear from the devotee's meditation and refuse to be found either by intense efforts or humble pleas. So there's many, many examples of this in the Shastra. This happened to Dhruva Maharaj, this happened to Narad Muni, this happened to King Malayadwaja. This particular way that Krishna deals with his devotees. So he's appearing in their mind and all of a sudden he disappears from their mind. And you have to remember that Krishna's been in their mind constantly, maybe for years, and all of a sudden he's gone. So then they make efforts, concentrate, you know, beg, please come back to my mind. Bhakti Notakura writes songs about this. In the agony of separation, the devotee opens his eyes to find his worshipful deities before him. He then erupts in a volcano of ecstatic bliss and bathes Radha and Krishna's feet with nectarian tears of love. So that this is the ultimate goal of seeing Krishna face to face. Now you may say, well then does the devotee die? Maybe. But maybe not. Then he goes on here, he says that The minds of such devotees depart for the unmanifest realm of Goloka, never to return to this material realm. Although their physical body continues to reside in this world, in reality they only appear to live here. Before they lived in this world and engaged a spiritual body in acts of perfection. So that's at the stage of bhava. So first a person is living here and engaging in acts of perfection through a mentally constructed body. Then the person is living here and engaging in acts of perfection mentally through Krishna manifesting them. Nothing no longer mentally constructed. So the spiritual world is existing in their mind and in their heart, but they're living here. Now at the stage of prema, they're not living here anymore. Then they're actually living in the spiritual world. It says, now they live in the perfect realm and engage the material body in service to the conditioned souls. So we gave the example that you're sitting in your room and your mind is elsewhere. So that's like at the stage up until prema. You're here, but in your mind and your heart, you're absorbed in Krishna. Either first in the mentally constructed body or later as Krishna manifests. At the stage of prema, you're not here. You're in the spiritual world. And you're you know, like one is you're remotely in the spiritual world and the other is you're remotely in the material world. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada's godbrother B.R. Sridhar Maharaj talks about this. Do you have both feet in the spiritual world, or do you have one foot in the spiritual world and one foot in the material world? Or do you have both feet in the material world and you're looking at the spiritual world? So both feet in the material world, looking at the spiritual world, would be up to the stage of constant remembrance. And then a constant remembrance and samadhi in the smarana stage, and also in samadhi at the bhava stage, you'd have one foot in the material world, one foot in the spiritual world, and at prema or at sampati, you'd have both feet in the spiritual world and you're looking at the material world. And Sridhar Maharaj writes here that the only thing that keeps a person at all in the material world, that keeps their body, that keeps any connection, is their chanting and their hearing, not their eating or their medicine. In fact, we see some people at that stage don't even eat. They don't engage in anything to maintain their body through material means. Although yogis can do that too, even without any kind of bhakti. There are yogis who can maintain their body without food and water, without the process of bhakti. All right, that finishes our description. Any questions on that? Then we have the summary. Sridhar Maharaj talks about rasas. I gave class about rasas this morning. So if you were there, we discussed a lot of these things this morning in class, so I'm not going to repeat them. Talks about why Krishna determined the why Krishna displayed his conjugal rasa. And the very end of this book, as I mentioned earlier, is a fictional story of a devotee who comes to the Hare Krishna movement and attains perfection. And I've personally found that to be most helpful. And I'd say if you don't read anything else in this book, at least read that. Because I personally find it much easier to understand something when it's become personalized. Mm-hmm. It goes then from theory to example. I remember in my graduate statistics class, the professor once wrote some formulas on the board. And I said, can you give a specific example? He said, yes, just like when z over the square root of 3 becomes... I said, no, I meant a real life example. So it's always nice to see a real life example. What does this mean? How does someone attain these stages? How would it play out in their life? What would it look like?
I'll make it. I
think one other thing just to mention is this book, Sudha Bhakti Chintamani, is very authoritative. It's based on many, 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 many shastra. At the same time, all books and all lectures by anybody, whether they're Sukadeva Goswami or Srila Prabhupada or Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, are always through the lens of their own understanding. And therefore, you'll find that different personalities may describe these same things in slightly different ways. And the concept of personal understanding, personal realization, is there at the highest level of reality because we're all persons. So this book has to be taken, just like all spiritual books that are very authoritative, they have to be taken both as, you know, this is the truth and it's my authority, and this is the realization and the view of this particular individual. Just like I was telling you with this thing in the Bhagavatam that was in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport, and Prabhupada's purport was so different. He was looking at very different aspects. He was talking about impersonalism and personalism. He was talking about something completely different. So that's through, you know, his own view of, as an individual, and also the preaching needs at the time, and so forth. Discussions? Anything?
Chitra Gopi always has questions.
It's a glorious day. We can go out today.
Yeah, it's not raining, is it?
Let me go out.
Just pee pee. Just pee pee. I mean, one thing is that this is really the essence of Krishna consciousness. This whole little chart here. Krishna consciousness, being aware of Krishna. I was reading Burajan Prabhu's book recently on japa, and he said that the beginners think that Krishna consciousness is a series of activities. But really, it's gaining depth of meditation on Krishna. Prabhupada said we shouldn't be so concerned about the things in this world. Reading recently a letter he wrote to a devotee whose husband had to be away for a long period of time. And he said, we shouldn't be so concerned about all these family activities and these things in this spot life. But put our attention as to how can I enter into deeper and deeper meditation on Krishna? How can I enter into deeper and deeper? You are. Yes, you are. Yes, you are, dear. Anything anybody want to discuss on this at all before we quit?
Why are you guys being so shy?
Did I intimidate everybody?
I'm kind of at the first part. So, and you said how to hear as much as possible, and that will help to get.
And it's not, remember, although we're putting this in the category of hearing, this is really given as stages in the Nectar of Instruction. This is really given as stages of remembering, as of smaranam. And in order to remember something, first you have to hear about it. So I'd say hear and make an effort to remember. To actually make an effort to remember. Whether it's remembering some of the philosophy, whether it's remembering some of Krishna's pastimes. Actually make an effort to remember. And can you wait till we're done, sweetie? Because we're not having a kirtan right now. Oh, look at your pant leg. I got to fix this again. Remember I told you it was going to come out if you jumped. Come here. I'm worried you're going to trip. The other thing that I personally would highly recommend is to follow Prabhupada's instructions about meditating on deity worship. I really highly recommend it.
Yes.
Both. Really, I would very, very strongly recommend.
And you'll come over here.
If that doesn't work for you, if you're not comfortable with that, if you don't like it, don't do it. But if it's something that you like, I would really encourage it. Specifically with Prabhupada. I mean, on the lowest level of that, he said things like, you're seeing the deity, you should see the deity from the feet to the knees, you know, to the chest. Can't you remember the form of the deity while you're chanting? Why can't you remember? He said, what is the difficulty? Why can't you remember the form of the deity? Why don't you remember? So at least remember the form of the deity. Better than that is doing service. Bhajan Prabhu was speaking about this, saying, just to remember Krishna's form is shantaras. Just to meditate on Krishna's form, you want to meditate on service. So Prabhupada in Geneva said, chanting Hare Krishna means you make a diamond throne for Krishna in your heart, you bring Ganga and Jamuna water, you bathe him, you dress him, you ornament him in various ways. Again, if that doesn't work for you, it's not that that's Prabhupada's only instruction. It's not that you must do that, but I'm really recommending it. If you're into it and you like it. And just like throughout the day, you know, throughout the day we meditate on, we assume mentally constructed bodies and we imagine ourselves in our mind. By the way, each of us has, in psychology, each of us has a preferred way of thinking of ourselves in our mind. Some of us do what's called associating, some of us do what's called dissociating. So if you imagine yourself in your mind, do you see yourself like you're watching a movie or do you see through your own eyes? All of us can do both, but we have a preferred. Sometimes when people have gone through trauma, one way that you get them out of that trauma is you have them recode the memory as if they're seeing themselves in the movie rather than seeing it through their own eyes. When you imagine seeing something through your own eyes as if you're in your body, in your mind, it's much stronger emotionally. You're connected emotionally. And when you see yourself like a movie, you're disconnected emotionally. So I would suggest that even if your preferred way of thinking about things is seeing yourself, you might start that way, but you might eventually want to come to actually feeling that you're in your mental body. Do you understand what I'm saying? One is you're seeing yourself like you're watching a movie of yourself, and one is you are feeling that you're in your body. And each individual has a preferred way of thinking about things. But just like throughout the day, you know, I think about, all right, okay, I gotta go. I'm traveling tomorrow to Ljubljana, so I gotta do, you know, what packing do I need to do tonight, and what am I gonna do about? We were talking about laundry. What am I gonna do about laundry? Am I gonna, this sari that I'm wearing, am I gonna wash it before I go, or am I gonna travel with a set of dirty clothes? Okay, if I wash before I go, am I going to wash it tonight and wear something else to sleep in? Am I going to wash it first thing in the morning? Do we think about things like this? Right? There's nothing in my refrigerator and I have to go shopping. When am I going to go shopping? I got to do this at 11 and this happens at 12 and maybe I can go at 1. And, right? And often we make even a picture of ourselves doing things. Okay, let's see, how will I do this? I got to meet with this person. Maybe practice what we're saying. And we become absorbed in our own activities. We're meditating on our own activities. Or we may be meditating on the activities of other people we care about. If someone we care about is sick, we may be thinking about, you know, they're in a distant place, and what are they doing, and they're in the hospital, and this is happening to them. Or, you know, this is happening. And like my daughter-in-law told me that her brother dislocated his shoulder and broke his arm, and so she was flying out to where he was and helping him pack his things. So I might think about that. I might think about what she's going through and how she's going there now and when can I reach her. And right? I might make a mental picture of that. So we're all doing that throughout the day. So you can also do that about Krishna. You can think about Krishna's activities or you can think about offering some service to Krishna. You can meditate that I'm offering Krishna a nice ghee lamp. And you know, what's nice about doing it mentally is that you can make it as nice as you like. You know, you can offer a diamond ghee lamp to Krishna. I met one devotee, one of my god sisters, who told me something that I've started to do all the time. She said that whenever she makes an offering to her deities, she mentally offers many more things than she physically offers. I thought, well, that's easy. Because, you know, I offer food to my deities at least once a day. I'm sure most of us make food offerings. So you can easily, you're doing it anyway. You know, you can mentally make the offering on a golden plate. And, you know, you're supposed to invite everyone to sit down before you give them something to eat. You know, if you do that, you invite them to sit on a seat, you invite your guru, Srila Prabhupada, and you invite the deities to sit on a seat, and then, you know, here's a seat, sit down, here's the food. Well, why not mentally actually offer them a nice seat? By the way, this is one of the standard required procedures of deity worship, is that deity worship is supposed to be offered both in a mentally and physically, all aspects of deity worship. But why not make it nicer? If you read the deity worship handbook, for example, one is supposed, this is part of the regulations of deity worship. Even if you just have a picture in your house, you know, and you're asking the Lord Chaitanya to sit down and you're going to feed them something. So mentally ask him to sit down on a gold seat with jewels and with silk cushions, and you give him a gold plate and put all the preparations in golden plates. I said this once at a meeting, and somebody asked me, that sounds so materialistic. Oh, that was so funny. And you can mentally offer so many things that you don't physically have. I mean, that shouldn't excuse laziness if you actually can make all those things. It's not that I just stick a banana on the altar and imagine I'm offering all kinds of other things when I actually could offer them. But even then, you can always imagine you're offering much more. And Krishna actually accepts that. Krishna actually accepts it. So that's a very simple way you can start having that kind of meditation. And anything you're doing for Krishna, any service you're doing for Krishna, you can mentally be offering something that's nicer than what you're able to physically offer.
I had this experience where when I was chanting, I would mentally offer like a proper room for Krishna and to actually give them their own room, and it actually ended up happening in the end. So.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. But even if it doesn't happen on the external platform, Krishna is accepting that. Krishna is accepting that. It's real. When Prabhupada talks about doing these things, he says it's actually real. Don't think that it's not real. It's accepted by Krishna. So that's something recommended for the beginner. And if you want to, there's many ways to speed up getting to an advanced stage. And this is one of them. Start actually thinking about Krishna. Don't wait for thinking about Krishna to fall on your head. Bhakti Vinod Thakur says, don't do that. Don't think, well, just someday by good fortune it will happen to me. You know, there's an effort to put Krishna in your mind. Being Krishna conscious does not mean just, of course it means this also, but it doesn't just mean an external ritual. It's not what it means, being Krishna conscious. The external rituals are meant to invoke Krishna consciousness and provide a platform for Krishna consciousness. And you can understand that Krishna consciousness is actually independent of our circumstances. You know, and this is something I say frequently, that we tend to think, just like the materialistic people think, that I need XYZ situation to be happy. Because material happiness is dependent on having contact of my senses with their objects on the platform of physical rasa, and of having nice emotional dealings on the platform of mental rasa, which we were talking about this morning, right? Physical rasa, mental, emotional rasa, and spiritual rasa. So to have physical rasa, I have to have a certain situation. My senses have to be touching their sense objects. The light from beautiful things has to be hitting my eyes. The wavelengths from nice sounds has to be hitting my ears. Soft substances have to be touching my skin. Right? There has to be some direct contact between the senses and the sense objects. Therefore, if that's my level of rasa, then I have to arrange my material circumstance. To have a nice emotional rasa, I have to surround myself with people who are emotionally congenial, which, as all of us have discovered in life, is not so easy. You know, it's not really that easy to make sure that all of the main players in our life are emotionally pleasant, especially at all times. In fact, to make sure all the main players in our life are emotionally pleasant at all times is impossible. You just can't do it. You keep trying, you know. You won't be able to do it. But that's also an arrangement, and that we try to do. So one we try to do by manipulating the gross matter, and the other we try to do by manipulating other people. And controlling other people. And we think that if I can just manipulate my environment and other people to be exactly what I want, then I would enjoy Russell. So several problems with that. The first problem is that neither physical nor emotional Russell is real Russell. And even if we could have it, it still wouldn't satisfy us. That's the first problem. Second problem is we'll never be able to perfectly manipulate the physical world. And third problem is we'll certainly never be able to perfectly manipulate other human beings. That will never happen. So what we're looking for is not what we really want, and the means to achieve it are impossible. So just imagine how frustrated we are. I'm trying to find a computer in a petrol shop. I'm trying to find Rasa in the body and the emotions. I ain't going to find it there. And the way I'm trying to find it, I'll never be 100% successful. I may be partially successful for a while. I may have, you know, nice clothes, good food, pretty house, pretty pictures on the wall, pleasant people for a while. But I can't keep it all the time. So we tend to think like that in spiritual life, too. We tend to bring this thing into spiritual life. And think the way to be spiritual is to manipulate my environment and the people around me to provide the perfect situation for spiritual Russell. You know, so I got to live in a temple, or I got to go live in Vrindavan. I have to have lots of pictures of Krishna on my wall. I have to, instead of making my environment so that it provides sense objects for my senses, I want to make my environment so everything around me reminds me of Krishna. And then instead of having the people around me so that they provide me with pleasant emotional experiences, I want to have the people around me so that they'll want to chat with me, and they'll want to go to the temple with me, and they'll want to go to holy places with me, and whatever my particular taste is. And I think if I do that, then I will be Krishna conscious. Now, obviously, if you can have all those things, Krishna consciousness is undoubtedly easier. Also, if you have all those things, there's a possibility of thinking you're Krishna conscious when you're not. Because the environment is so saturated that you just think, oh, yes, I'm Krishna conscious. And you don't realize that you haven't been thinking about the little blue boy playing his flute for the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. You know, you're thinking, and I've had this experience. I've had this experience of being in a situation where my environment and the people around me are all spiritually supportive, and I'm going to Mangalartik every day, and I'm getting all my 16 rounds done by 7 in the morning every day, and I'm reading Prabhupada's books every day, and there's no nonsense in my life whatsoever. And you just think, oh yeah, I'm a devotee. And I'm Krishna conscious. And I'm very Krishna conscious. And I'm a very advanced devotee. And it never occurs to you that you haven't been meditating on Krishna once. Never. It hasn't even happened. You know, once in a year or once every 3 months or something like that. So although that sort of environment can be more conducive, it can also be more... it's like taking birth as a devotee or taking birth in a nice... Vaishnava family in India or something. Yeah. You think, oh yes, I already know everything about Krishna. So it has that possible downside to it. But the other thing that I've seen, just like you can never find a perfect material arrangement that stays, you can never find a perfect spiritual arrangement that stays. First of all, to even make a perfect spiritual arrangement at all is almost impossible. There'll be something in your environment or some person in your environment that is not exactly the way you want to have supportive for your Krishna consciousness. Or something in your own body. You know, even if you're living in the Dham and... I mean, I was just thinking about Ayendra, you know. So he lived in Vrindavan for so many years. He had all these boys who helped chanting. But he had a lot of political problems with the temple administrations. He had a lot of people criticized him. A lot. A lot of people who didn't support him. Who didn't help him think about Krishna, but who were opposing him. And a lot of enemies. So there you are in Vrindavan in the 24-hour kirtan, and there's still people who are making spiritual life difficult for you. And then I say, what to speak of your own body? Speak of your own mind. You carry that around with you. So to find a perfect situation for spiritual life in this world will probably not happen, even if you go to Lord Brahma's planet. And even if you did have the perfect situation, that doesn't necessarily mean that that in and of itself is going to give you Krishna consciousness. It just doesn't. So my suggestion to people is, put 10% of your energy into making your situation favorable and 90% of your energy into becoming Krishna conscious in whatever situation you have. Put the bulk of your energy into becoming Krishna conscious. You don't know how much time you have. Otherwise, we'll spend all of our time, you know, trying to convince everybody that I live with and work with that they should be Krishna conscious as much as I am in the same way that I am. Maybe they want to be Krishna conscious in another way. And I'll be spending all my energy into adjusting my circumstances, moving here, moving there, this place, that place, changing this service, this thing, that thing. I only have so much energy. And none of that energy is going into meditating on Krishna. It's kind of like, you know, you shop, you get all your kitchen equipment, you know, you got to cook at some point. So I see this as a big trick of the illusory energy. That she says, first you got to do this, first you got to do this, first you have to have this, then you have to have this. This is not right yet, this is not right yet. Then you'll be able to meditate on Krishna when this is right and this is, and you've done this and you've done this and you've done that, and put your energy into doing this and doing that and doing the other thing and doing the other thing. And it's a diversion. And this is one of the symptoms of unsteady bhakti, according to Madhurya Kadambini. This indecision, the person that their energy is going into, should I be married or not married? That's it. That's Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's main thing. Should I be married or unmarried? And should I live in Vrindavan or should I work in the world? Those are the two things he brings up. But, you know, what should I do? My mind goes back and forth. Would this be better? 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 So to make the effort, it's another thing you can do to advance quickly, is just say, I'm going to meditate on Krishna in whatever circumstances I have. You know, if my body's broken and in pain, and if I'm living with meat eaters and wine drinkers who are watching television, if I'm living in Vrindavan, if I'm working at a bank, if I'm going out on book distribution, whatever situation that I'm in, how can I meditate on Krishna now? Instead of let me first make my situation perfect and then I'll meditate. And put some effort into making a nice situation. I'd say minimal. Really minimal. Don't waste your time that way. And then other ways to advance quickly are to be willing to be completely honest with oneself about oneself. And this is probably the hardest thing to do. But to be willing with courage to see oneself honestly. See, honestly, where am I in Krishna consciousness? What do I need to do to progress? What do I need to give up? What attachments do I need to do? And another way is to let go of attachments as soon as Krishna makes it completely obvious that one needs to do so. To never hold on to attachments. By attachments, I don't necessarily mean things or situations. I mean mindsets. Sometimes it may mean things or situations also. Sometimes it may mean, you know, getting rid of a television set. Or moving away from a particular friendship or something. So sometimes it may mean that. Sometimes it may mean changing a job. Or I was talking to one devotee who told me, he said, well, the job I have now is such, I work all night, and what I do is I work in nightclubs supervising the go-go dancing girls. I said, I really don't think that's a very good job for your spiritual life. He says, well, if I quit the job, how will I make any money? I said, you know, I'm sure there's other ways you can make money. So sometimes it may mean, you know, letting go of attachment to a circumstance. But mostly it means letting go of attachment to something, to some mental attachment. I mean, in his case, even it was a mental attachment. It was thinking, you know, making money is so important that I have to be willing to make money anyway, in any way, shape, or form. It was a lack of faith in Krishna, really. That Krishna, that if I do honest work, that Krishna will still take care of me. That if I tell Krishna, Krishna, I'm only going to do honest, pious work, that I'll be okay. He's thinking, if I give up this job, how will I have any money? So it wasn't so much giving up the job, it was giving up that concept that Krishna's not my maintainer. So as soon as Krishna reveals that there's some kind of attachment we have, give it up. Let go. Trust. Maintaining material attachments in spite of understanding so many instructions on this. So that's a huge one. You know, you hear something in a purport, one of those times you read something in a purport, you hear it in a lecture, and it hits you right in the face. You've had those, I mean, that happened to me just a few days ago. Listening to a lecture from Srila Prabhupada where he said something, and I went, Oh. Do I really have to do that? And I thought, yes, I do. I really do. So, I don't know if I really want to do that. And it's just, you want to attain Krishna or not? What do you want? What price are you willing to pay? Are you willing to pay that price or not? I said, well, okay, I'll do it at least for a month. We'll see. That, by the way, is one of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's suggestions, which I found extremely helpful. He says, take a vow for 3 days. He says, then for a month, then for 3 months. And I've sort of broken it up more than that, like especially if it's a really difficult thing, that your mind is just going crazy and say, oh, if you do that, your whole life will fall apart. You know, then you just tell your mind, it's just 3 days, okay? So shut up. We can always go back after 3 days. So I found if it's a really hard thing, 3 days, then a week, then 2 weeks, then a month, then 3 months, and then reevaluate at the end of 3 months and say, how is this working? Do I still want to do this? This for both positive and negative things. Both positive and negative things. Things you want to give up and things you want to take on. That when Krishna reveals to you, hey, this is a step you should take, if you're hesitant to take it and you think, I don't know if I can handle this, and your mind is having a whole temper tantrum, well, like a little baby, then you can just say, okay, we're doing it for 3 days. I remember when I did this with something that was very, 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 very scary. Very scary. I didn't know how I would live. I did it for 3 days. And what was really funny is on the fourth day, I forgot it was the fourth day. At the end of the fourth day, I said, oh, I didn't have to keep doing that. I only took a vow for 3 days. I said, oh, okay. It was a really scary thing. I said, okay, I'll do it for a week. See how it goes. 2 weeks, then 1 month. So now it's been, I think, about 2 or 2.5 years. But I still keep doing it every 3 months. I'm not willing to say I'm going to do this for the rest of my life yet. Because as soon as I say I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, my mind says, but what about if this happens? So I'll probably do it for the rest of my life. But I do it 3 months at a time. So I really like Bhaktivinoda Thakur's suggestion. It's something like the alcoholics who vow to be sober for today. That when the alcoholics say, I'm going to be sober the rest of my life, they can't do it. It's too much. They get overwhelmed. But if they say, I'm going to be sober today. So whatever it is, whatever positive and negative things, if it's something that we see, this is something like Krishna is making it abundantly clear that I need to do this. That I need to either take on something positive or let go of something negative. If you can just do it and just do it and be done with it, that's wonderful. And if you can't do that, you can do it in stages. And you know, reevaluate. And after your 1 week or 1 month, say, how's it going? Have I died? Am I miserable? Has my world collapsed? And I found some things that I did, I decided not to keep doing. There were certain things that I did that I said, you know, okay, I did this. I learned something. I learned that it was okay. I learned that my world didn't fall apart, but I don't really want to keep doing this. I don't think it's necessary. I think that, you know, 1 month or 3 months was enough. and I've learned what I needed to learn. Or I might say, this really didn't, it just didn't work well for me. It was too much stress. It was too much difficulty. I want to do it in another way. Make some changes. And say, well, or this circumstances. Another way to really advance quickly is always treat other living entities kindly, even if they don't treat you kindly. Devotees, non-devotees, just be kind. So hard. It's so hard to do that. It is really hard. The time when it's really hard is when we feel afraid. I was realizing that the times that I get nasty to other people, and by the way, I often don't realize I'm being nasty. I often think I'm just being practical. And recently I had someone say to me, Ermila, this thing you said to me really hurt. And I didn't think I was saying anything hurtful. I thought I was being practical. And then this devotee said to me, okay, Ermila, just imagine that we turned the tables and I had said it to you under the same circumstance. How would you feel? And then I thought, whoa. Would you think I was just being practical? Or would you think I was being cruel? I said, I thought you'd be... I think you were being cruel. I said, but I never thought about it like that. And the devotee said, yeah, you didn't think about how I would feel when you said that. I thought, no, I just thought I had to get a job done and I needed to communicate something to you that was important. And then... What I saw is the only time I do that is when I'm afraid. When I think, if I don't let this person know exactly what needs to be done and exactly how I feel and this and this and this, I'm going to suffer in some way. So that we lose our good qualities when we're afraid, which is something I talk about a lot. So to always be kind to others and to notice if there's something that scares you. If there's something that scares you, ask for courage. And the thing I found to be very helpful is just to say, Krishna is going to take care of all of my needs. Krishna is going to take care of all of my needs. Krishna is going to take care of all of my needs. Krishna is going to take care of all of my needs. Even if this person I'm doing business with cheats me. I mean, I was recently in a situation where someone I was doing business with sent me something in writing and I thought, this person is trying to cheat me. And my reaction was going to be then to be heavy. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm going to offend this person. I'm going to damage my relationship with them. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid they're going to cheat me. I'm afraid I'm going to be cheated. I'm afraid I'm going to be poverty stricken. Krishna's going to take care of all my needs. I can deal with this person kindly, and Krishna will take care of me. And even if they cheat me, and even if I end up poverty stricken on the street, Krishna will still take care of me somehow. And then you can be kind. Whenever we hurt other living entities, I mean, this is just a point repeated over. I was just reading it in the 11th canto about the qualities of a guru. And the qualities of a disciple. And the first thing a disciple has to do is be kind to all living entities. Which is why one of our principles is vegetarianism. But, you know, we talk about being kind to the cows, and then we're not kind to the people. Like we say to the ordinary people, you know, you're nice to your dogs, but you're not nice to the cows. So, you know, we're nice to the cows, but we're not nice to our husband, or we're not nice to our kid, or we're not nice to our friends, or we're not nice to our boss. So, to be kind. I think we can only be kind when you have courage. Because almost all the times we're nasty with others because we're afraid. But if I'm kind, if I'm considerate, then I'll be mistreated. And I'll be taken advantage. That doesn't mean you have to be a fool, but you can always be kind. You can always think of not doing harm to anybody. And obviously, if somebody's trying to rape you and kill you, you know. But even then, it should be without malice. Without malice. You know, you may need to punch the guy in the face or something, but without malice. Does that make sense? Without malice.
Is it very sweet?
Actually, with compassion.
What is
it? It's kind of like when you chastise a child. It hurts you more than it hurts the child. Disgusting.
So I'm sure there's others in the list, but that's some of my list of how to make the process go faster. That I see particularly seem to be blocks for people. And one reason to make the process go faster is that it's very, very difficult to maintain being an unsteady devotee for a long period of time. Because when you're an unsteady devotee, and Shri Ramaraj talks about this also, I'm not sure if it's in this book. But when you're in this platform of unsteady devotion, it's not a very satisfying place to be. You're not experiencing spiritual happiness regularly, and you're not experiencing material sense gratification. So, and you just can't stay in a platform without pleasure very long. You just can't. We're pleasure-seeking beings. You just can't. And so the tendency will be to go to material sense gratification. So you want to get through the unsteady stage as fast as you possibly can.
This is me.
All right, I think I've talked enough.
Are you hungry?
Mommy. Yeah, sure, I can eat more.
You, some runs on the clock.
I wasn't thinking about eating.
Mommy. Yes.
But probably everybody else is hungry. Thank you.
Thank you.